Oh, God, make him pull over, I said, as the car slung around yet another curve in almost total darkness. It had been nearly 4 hours since we'd left the naval base at Alt Bay, and we'd been careening from checkpoint to checkpoint since. I truly believe those were the only times the driver used the brakes. At the last checkpoint, I was copiously sick, narrowly missing the guard's boots. He didn't even bother checking our papers, just lifted the red and white pole and waved us on with a look of disgust.
"Driver, pull over," said Alice,
who was sitting in the back seat between Hank and me.
"I'm afraid there is no over,"
the driver said, in a thick Highland accent, his R's rolling magnificently. He came to a stop in the middle of the road. It was true. If I stepped outside the car, I would be ankle-deep in thorny vegetation and mud. Not that it would have done any more to destroy my clothes and shoes. From head to toe, I was steeped in sulfur and cordite and the stench of fear. My stockings were mere cobwebs stretched around my legs, and my scarlet nails were broken and peeling. I hadn't had my hair done since the day before we'd sailed from the shipyard in Philadelphia. I had never been in such a state. I leaned out the open door and gagged while Ellis rubbed my back. Wet snow collected on the top of my head. I sat up again and pulled the door shut. "I'm sorry. I'm finished. Do you think you can take those things off the headlights? I think it would be better if I could see what's coming." I was referring to the slotted metal plates our one-eyed driver had clipped on before we'd left the base. They limited visibility to about 3 feet ahead of us.
"Can't,"
he called back cheerfully.
"It's a blackout."
As he cranked up through the gears, my head lurched back and forth. I leaned over and cradled my face in my hands. Ellis patted my shoulder.
"We should be nearly there. Do you think fresh air would help?"
I sat up and let my head flop against the back of the torn leather seat. Ellis reached across and rolled the window down a crack. I turned toward the cold air and closed my eyes. "Hank, can you please put out your cigarette?" He didn't answer, but a whoosh of frigid air let me know he had tossed it out the window. "Thank you," I said weakly. 20 minutes later, when the car finally came to a stop and the driver cut the engine, I was so desperate for solid ground, I spilled out before the driver could get his own door open, never mind mine. I landed on my knees.
"Maddie,"
Ellis said in alarm. "I'm all right," I said. There was a fast-moving cloud cover under a nearly full moon, and by its light, I first laid eyes on our unlikely destination. I climbed to my feet and reeled away from the car, thinking I might be sick again. My legs propelled me toward the building, spinning ever faster. I crashed into the wall, then slid down until I was crouching against it. In the distance, a sheep bleated. To say that I wished I wasn't there would be a ludicrous understatement, but I'd only ever had the illusion of choice.
"We have to do this," Hank had said. "It's for Ellis."
To refuse would have been tantamount to betrayal, an act of calculated cruelty. And so, because of my husband's war with his father and their insane obsession with a mythical monster, we'd crossed the Atlantic at the very same time a real madman, a real monster, was attempting to take over the world for his own reasons of ego and pride. I would have given anything to go back 2 weeks to the beginning of the New Year's Eve party and script the whole thing differently.